The first candle of the Advent wreath is called Hope, and the second is called Peace. But it isn't peace in the sense of the absence of conflict. It's something positive. It is prosperity. It is calm. It is good. In the great depths of the ocean, if you were to go there with a conventional submarine, the pressures down there would crush the hull like an empty Coke can in your hand. And so scientists have invented and built bathyspheres, which are made out of thick steel and thick glass. They are small and they are tough for the scientists to move about, but they are thereby saved from the tremendous pressures of the ocean depths. The whole idea is that you equalize the pressure inside with the pressure on the outside so you're not crushed. When those oceanographers settle on the deep ocean floor and turn on their floodlights, what they see through the small window is fish with thin skins, and they don't implode. And the reason is that they have on the inside an equal and opposite pressure to that which is on the outside. And therefore, they can swim about freely and easily. And that's what peace is. Not the absence of pressure and conflict about us, but an equal and opposite pressure on the inside that keeps what's on the outside from crushing us. Joseph was a man under pressure. The stress and circumstances were enough to take his breath away as if he were going to be crushed. And he's part of the Christmas story. For this is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about. His mother Mary was pledged to be married to Joseph, but before they came together, she was found to be with child through the Holy Spirit. To understand what was going on, we need to understand some of the customs that were followed in terms of marriage in first century Israel. You see, engagement meant that the young man and the young woman were planning to be married to each other. However, it was most often an arranged marriage, sometimes through the fee of a matchmaker, but always through the arrangement of the parents. The theory was that marriage was extremely important and that such an important decision could never be entrusted to the couple, that the parents need to make that decision for them. And the decision was often made when they were still children. So it could well be that you would be 6 or 10 years old and engaged to someone that you've never met, that in fact you have never even seen. Years later, the engagement became a betrothal. That actually was a formal process with legal standing. It was considered legally binding, lasted for a year, and the couple referred to one another and were referred to as husband and wife. Between the engagement and the betrothal, there was an opportunity to opt out, although there was huge social pressure to stay in the relationship. At the end of the 1 year of betrothal came the wedding. And with the wedding came a huge community-based reception that could last a week, maybe even 2 weeks, as family and friends and everyone partied together. And it was only after the wedding and the reception that the couple moved in together and sexually consummated the relationship of marriage that was now theirs. Well, it was during this 1 year betrothal period that Joseph found out that Mary was pregnant. We're not told how he found out. Perhaps it was that Mary herself told him. Or maybe it was information that leaked out of her family and household. You know, one person in complete confidence told somebody else in the community, and then they promised that it would be kept as a secret until that secret was shared with someone else, and the word spread all throughout that small town to everyone but Joseph, who finally found out that the woman that he was going to marry was going to have a baby. And his life caved in. for it seemed quite obvious to him what had happened. He had assumed that she loved him. He had assumed that she was a virgin. He had assumed that she was a completely different kind of woman than he had now found her out to be. So how do you describe the churning inside of him, this mixture of love and disappointment and anger? He was hurt and humiliated. He was mad, but he still loved her and wanted her. It was a small town. Soon everybody would know. Maybe they already did. And perhaps they even knew what he didn't know. Who was the guy who had impregnated his fiancée? He must have wondered how to respond, whether he should put his fist through a wall or get out and get drunk or just cry or leave town, just leave town and never have to face anybody again because of the shame that was his. For gone were his dreams, the dream of this great wedding and wonderful happy reception and living happily ever after. It was gone forever. Perhaps you know that when caught by surprise, when crushed by circumstances, when deeply disappointed, it is hard to imagine that even God himself could ever make life good again. And maybe you do understand, because maybe somewhere in a file cabinet of past emotions, you experienced something of what Joseph experienced. Betrayal, hurt, feelings for which there are no words of description. Or maybe you're there now. Maybe you're just really hurting. Maybe you would say it's something like having a Major League Baseball player walk up to you with a bat and swing as hard as he can, right into your gut, and you can hear your own ribs snap and your breath taken away. It was crushing for Joseph. His life was caving in, but he was a good man. And he wanted to do the right thing. We're not all like that. There are many of us who just want to get even. We want to apply that ancient code of retribution, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But when we're upset enough, it's more than getting even. We want to even inflict more damage on the other person than the damage that we got ourselves. We want revenge, but not Joseph. Because Joseph, her husband, was a righteous man and did not want to expose her to public disgrace, he had in mind to divorce her quietly. So here he had concern and compassion for this woman who had so cruelly betrayed him. For he knew from the information that he had that she was immoral, that she was unfaithful. Under Hebrew law, she had committed a capital crime and could be stoned to death. In his wildest imagination, Joseph could not imagine any kind of acceptable explanation for her pregnancy. And yet he wanted to protect her from embarrassment and from harassment and from public disgrace. I admire the man. I would like to be like him. For it seems to me that the common response to such a situation is criticism and condemnation. You've heard, you've seen the response of those who are deeply wronged. Maybe you've read some of the divorce papers. You know that the things that are written and the things that are spoken can be vitriolic, that they can be just so vicious. Because the hurt is so deep and great. Rarely is there a lot of love or compassion or generosity. Joseph wasn't a Christian, for there was not yet a Christ. But he did respond Christianly. He had a behavior that was distinctive, for the first thing in his mind was to do what was right, not to retaliate or to compensate for his own injury. To do what was right. And I think to myself, it's no wonder that out of a whole generation of men, God picked Joseph to be the human father to raise his son on earth, because he wanted him to have the kind of dad who most of all wanted to do the right thing. May we all be like Joseph. May you and I have a response that seeks to do the right thing when we're cheated, when we're attacked, when we're betrayed, when we're criticized, because I'll tell you, the world is full of people who get aggressive, defensive, and self-centered, and see everybody else as the enemy. But blessed are those who say, I'm going to do the right thing, no matter whether the other person has done the wrong thing to me. Well, Joseph had pretty much made up his mind what the right thing was. He was going to divorce her, but he was going to do it in a decent way, privately and quickly and quietly. He wasn't going to say anything ill about Mary. He would simply carry those things in his heart. And if it were possible to get a quick and quiet divorce, maybe she could quickly and quietly marry the man who had impregnated her. And at least she could be happy. For Joseph was going to have to carry this heartbreak with him for the rest of his life. And then I wonder, once the decision was made, how he went to sleep that night. I imagine that perhaps he cried himself to sleep. I wondered if he wanted to sob, if he was like most men in that generation in Israel. He did not live alone. That was a luxury that very few had. He would most likely have been in a house with an extended family. And so the sobs had to be silent. He may have tried to stay awake, thinking that that would prolong the night. For when the sun rose, it meant that he had to do what he had decided to do. But sleep crept up on him. And finally he dozed off. And when he did, he dreamed. An angel of the Lord appeared to him in that dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. Now, when he awakened the next morning, he had to think that this was the strangest dream that he had ever had. He may have even laughed for the first time in days. Laughed at the amazing ingenuity of the human mind to rationalize absolutely anything. To come up with this far-fetched dream that somehow would get him back with and married to Mary. He couldn't have thought it was real and true. For how would he ever know that he was at the very epicenter of a prediction made by the prophet Isaiah hundreds of years earlier, that all this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet? The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. Now, I've got to tell you that when people say to me that they have had a dream from God and God has told them something directly, I'm kind of a skeptic. You know, I think to myself, what did you eat for dinner, like the night before? And have you been smoking that stuff again? You know, you are going to get in serious trouble if you keep up with this addictive habit. You had a dream, and God gave you a vision of an angel, and God told you about getting married. Come on. So I wondered what I would say if that next day Joseph had called or come to me and said, well, you know, should I believe this? Should I do it? Or should I just let it go? It's kind of a strange, unconnected nightmare. I think that I would say, Joseph, do it. Go for it. Yes, I believe that your dream is from God. And I would say that not because of the content of the dream, nor the circumstances that he was in. I would say it because of the kind of man that I have come to know Joseph to be. He was solid and steadfast and predictable and godly. He was not the kind of man who chased after wacky visions. And so I would say, Joseph, I believe that you have a message from God. But it raises the question of what I would do if in the 21st century, I were in the same or some similar kind of vice in facing an impossible decision, like Joseph, I would pray. I would pray like I had never prayed before in my life. And I would read the Bible and seek there to find perspective and wisdom from God. I would go to those whom I had already, before the crisis arrived, decided were wise and godly people who would give good counsel and advice. I don't think that I would expect God to speak to me in the same way that he spoke to Joseph. I wouldn't demand of God that there be some kind of angelic appearance or a dream, because the whole point here is that the message was from God, not a focus on the method that God used. When Joseph awakened the next morning, he faced one of the most important decisions of his entire life. When Joseph woke up, he did what the angel of the Lord had commanded him and took Mary home as his wife. That was not an easy thing to do. It was a hard swallowing of his pride. He knew that there would be rumors and gossip for the rest of their marriage. He recognized that there would not be a day to come when there would not be unanswered questions that he would struggle with time after time. He recognized that every morning he would see the face of a child for whom he was responsible and accountable, but he was not the physical father of that child. But he did it because it was the right thing to do, not because it was the easy thing. The easy thing was to dump her. Dump her and go find some other woman and let her take care of her own problems herself. Cut his losses and go on with life. But that wasn't Joseph. He would do the right thing even when it was the hard thing. Years later, it was Jesus who said, "Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it." He was smart enough to recognize that doing the hard thing up front is the better way later, and taking the easy path up front can have enormous difficulties, far greater than you ever would have envisioned later in life. For him, it was not only the emotional strain and the social pressure, but it was also sexual deprivation. It's kind of bizarre that this would be included in the Christmas story, because it's private information, intimate information. It's the kind of thing that we really wouldn't think that we would need to know. But it is particularly interesting to those of us in the 21st century, for we live at a time and a place in history where sexual satisfaction has risen to become a virtual right. So much so that we will say, "I want it here and I want it now," regardless of whether I am yet married or if I, in fact, am married to someone else. That sexual satisfaction without any divine boundaries is something that I need and something that I want, and that has become a high priority for many within our culture. So it's something of an amazing thing when we look at Joseph, who was willing to postpone a sexual relationship that he had every right to exercise. He waited. He waited a long time. And he waited because it was the right thing to do. He waited because he really believed Mary when she said she was a virgin. He waited because he wanted there to be no doubt when Jesus was born that he had been miraculously conceived. He waited because he put God's plan and Jesus' reputation ahead of his own sexual passion. Joseph had no union with Mary until she gave birth to a son, and he gave him the name Jesus. You know, we can get stressed out just thinking of what this man put up with, the life that he had. Everything was going along fine. An engagement was shattered by betrayal. There was hurt and anger. a supposedly supernatural dream, decisions to make, a hurry-up wedding, sexual abstinence, the birth of a baby, and that was only the beginning of all that he went through. And yet he seems to have such peace, such calm. He seems so centered and so settled. And I want to know, how does he do this? How does he have this peace on the inside when a tornado is swirling around him on the outside? The answer is the baby. That the coming of Jesus into his life settled his soul. That God showed him the right way and that he chose to follow it, and that he offers to us a formula that works for us too. That when life caves in, we choose to do what is right. That we listen up to what God has to say, and that when we wake up from our dreams, we decide to actually do what God has called us to do, no matter what the price. And then we too experience the peace of God. Gordon MacDonald is a popular author and speaker. We have known each other, I think, for most of our lives, and our fathers were good friends before we were born. After Gordon gave a lecture, he was approached by a Nigerian woman who is a physician at a large American teaching hospital. She introduced herself with a very common American name. He asked her, what is her African name? And she spoke a series of syllables that he could not begin to mimic, but he said that they had sort of a musical sound to them. He asked her, what does your African name mean? And she explained that her name means child who takes the anger away. And then she told her story. Her story that her parents had been very much in love, but that their parents forbid them to marry. They defied their parents and married anyway. And as a result, were disowned by both families and ostracized, so that they had no conversation with their parents for years. And then this Nigerian-born American physician said, my mother became pregnant with me. And when I was born, my grandparents came to see me, and they held me, and they loved me. And the walls of hostility came down, and I became the one who swept their anger away. And that's the name my mother and father gave to me. The same can be said about another name. It is the name of the one who settles the tumultuous heart, who heals the tormented soul, the one who equalizes the pressure on the inside in the midst of the storm and crisis on the outside. It is he who brings the alienated together. He is the child who takes the anger away. He is the one who brings peace. And his name is Jesus. Father, thank you for sending your Son into our conflicted world, into our conflicted lives, so that we may have peace through Jesus. Amen.